an hour and 15 minutes, and I don't know how to introduce this guy, so I'm just going to say, here is Dave from Texas.
Thank you, Tom. Hi, everybody. My name is David A., and I am an alcoholic. And before I get started lying, I want to thank the committee for inviting me to participate in this magnificent weekend. And several have told me, Tom over here from Winnipeg says, David, you don't have to give the best talk you know how, because anything you have to say will help this bunch. And Natalie, your beautiful delegate, asked me if I was nervous. Honey, I've been to the washroom so many times, the last time I just stood there, you know. And this is quite a humbling, sobering experience to stand in a place where one has been bodily ejected two times from. And I was telling several that at one occasion in my life when I was in the more respectable days of living, drinking, if that's respectable the way I drank, and I was on aboard a ship over at Bremerton, and I got mad at someone, and I came over to Seattle to get drunk at them, and it took me 2 weeks from the elevator to the old door that used to be a revolving door in this hotel, and I'd get about halfway there, and I said, no, I'll leave tomorrow. And so at the end of 2 weeks, at the insistence of the management, I finally got through the door. And the way I got through the door, I was thrown through the door. And I was pointed in the direction of the hill going down Seneca, and it says, by the water there is a place where we believe you will be more welcome. And I was. I'm one of these in Alcoholics Anonymous that believes that, as it was read in Chapter 5, that our discourse disclosed in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. And this is all I know about me as an alcoholic, and I know only one thing, and the only thing that I need to know one day at a time now, that AA works. Because it will soon be 26 years, the last weekend of August of 1950, that a group of fine, sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous invited me to come to an AA birthday party at the old Suburban Group in Dallas. Now, a lady who was my manicurist at the time said that she was going to celebrate 1 year in a deal called Alcoholics Anonymous, and then they gave a birthday party for those members of AA who were sober 1 or more consecutive years of sobriety. And I knew Edith was lying because I drank a lot of whiskey with Edith, and nobody stayed sober a year, maybe a day or two, or maybe a week, but nobody a year, and not particularly that one. But I noticed that when I went down and I was in my more lucid moments and I'd go down to the barbershop for a manicure, I noticed she had changed, that all of a sudden when she was buffing my nails instead of my knuckles, you know. And she wasn't drawing blood with a cuticle pusher. And her lipstick was on her lips and not of her eyebrows. And back in those days, the gals, before pantyhose, used to wear garter belts. And hers always trailed behind her uniform. And in those days, the ladies wore seams on the back of their hose, and hers, when she was... You talk to her drunk, they were in the front, but these were in the back. And they used to wear those platform high, sling pumps and sling heel shoes. And I noticed her toes were in the toes and the heels were in the heels. And she didn't grab her purse and was running to the ladies' room every 10 minutes. She quit smelling halfway between a woman, an Avon woman, and a whiskey bottle, you know. But I noticed something else about Edith, and something that I was not to come to realize for a number of years, and that is those beautiful eyes. Her eyes had changed. In AA, we call them sober eyes or troubled eyes. Now, Edith wasn't a very pretty lady. She looked like a truck had run over her face and then backed up to make sure it had done a good job. And she had these big pop eyes, and her nose was on the side of her face, and she had gaps in her teeth, but gosh, she was a great gal. and the eyes made the big difference. And then she introduced me to another lady, also a manicurist in the same barbershop, and she says, Moena here now is my sponsor, and she has 15 months sober in this deal called Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, here's a barbershop with 15 barbers, 14 manicurists, 8 shine boys, 2 porters, and 2 cashiers, and 40 customers in there. And there was an alcoholic that some of you may know, and God bless him, he's passed on, Al Badger. And Al walked like a duck, and Al was running up and down and telling everybody, he's coming to the AA meeting, you need to come, you need to come. I thought that the only reason that people such as you would invite someone such as me to come to one of your AA functions in those days is that you needed to have some good-looking, outstanding, and professional man come and upgrade you kind of people in the community, you know. And I was ready to come help you. They invited my wife to come, and she was glad because I was going places without her. And so that Sunday morning, I got dressed to get ready to go to the birthday party that afternoon. And as any good self-respecting drinking drunk would do, while I was getting dressed, I drank a half quart of whiskey. Because after all, I'm going out with a bunch of alcoholics, you know. And you have to remember that fishermen fish and golfers golf and drunks drink, and that's all there's to it. And so I put the other half of the quart in the back end of the car in the trunk because I knew that I was going to have me another drink. I was not to realize the reason that I demanded another drink. And I wished I'd saved the clothes that I came to that meeting almost 26 years ago. The suits had wide lapels. They'd be in style today. And I was very affluent, so I thought. And I had on this beautiful tailor-made suit, beige, quarter-inch stitching. And I got dressed, and I put on a white-on-white monogram shirt, monogram handkerchief, monogram drawers. I put on my diamond ring, my diamond Rolex watch, and the trademark of every good, self-respecting, high-rolling, drinking drunk. A brand-new pair of custom-made alligator shoes. I wished I'd have saved the tie that I come to that meeting with over 25 years ago. It, too, would have been in style, and it was a wide tie, and after World War II, many of you remember, I believe, that we used to wear those hand-painted ties, and I had a beautiful, wide, hand-painted tie that would fit that rig. It was a beige tie, and when you tied it, it had 2 hand-painted figures. When you tied the knot up above, there was a sailfish sailing over the moon, and down on the wide part was a Hawaiian hula girl with all of her personality characteristics showing. And I'd wear that tie in the places I'd drink, and the drunker you got, her look down and her personality would change. And it was quite a trademark. And so my wife and I went, and we got into a Roadmaster Buick with holes in the fenders, looked more like a funeral car. And off we went to the meeting. And we got out there, and I made a move 2 cars to park in the front because, after all, someone was important to come to help you people. And as we got to go up to the steps to the meeting place in the clubhouse, there were 2 drunks that were sitting on the steps, and they were drunk. And they wouldn't let them come in the meeting because they were too drunk. And one of them said something to me, and I did not want him to mess up my fine clothes and shoes. So I hit him very gently. And then I parked him over here, and his buddy that was over here took offense at it, and I hit him and parked him over there. And we went on into the meeting. And we went in, there must have been about 80 people there, and everybody smoking cigarettes and hugging and kissing, you know. And after I got sober, I realized there was some over in the corner doing some of them things that sometimes cause new groups to get formed every now and then. And I looked around and I saw all of those signs, you know, first things first. I said, my God, I'm in a kindergarten, you know. And then I saw what I still believe is the most dangerous sign that you can put in an AA facility or an AA group, and that's the one that says, think. You know, it's dangerous for our kind of folks to think. Drunk, sober, dead. And if you don't believe it, you pat a little drunk on the head and tell him how good he's doing in Alcoholics Anonymous and then let him get over in the corner and start thinking for himself, and he'll get drunker than an $8 bill on you. They blew a whistle or something, and everybody went into the meeting. And I went in, and I sat on the back row. After all, I was going to look you people over. And now the first celebrant that got up was a lady, not the one that invited us to come to the birthday party. And I knew her well. I drank a lot of whiskey with her. And she got up, and there she was, and she said she was sober and sane in her right mind. And I said, you're a liar. And then she started talking, and she says a miracle had happened in her life. And I thought I knew a lot about this lady.
And she kept talking about this great miracle, and I kept hollering out, well, tell it, you know. And she says this great miracle, as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, she had caught Christ back in her life. And then if anyone who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, unless they found Jesus Christ as their higher power, personal savior, there was no way in the world that they could stay sober in AA. And I said to myself, what a heck of a trick to pull on a Jew, you know. That they got me here to convert me, that's what it was. Now I'm asked all the time, how come there are not any more Jews in Alcoholics Anonymous? And it's very simple. The way people have their noses fixed and their names changed, you don't know who you're sitting next to. And you know, later on you come to AA and you hear all of these stories and you can compare yourself out of the door. And when I come to AA to get sober later on, I thought I didn't qualify. Everybody got up and said they come from a fine Christian home and they had a fine Christian upbringing, you know. And I didn't. I didn't even marry a fine Christian woman, you know. And they kept saying, you know, that nobody forces a drink down you. Well, you know, in the religion I was born in, you know, at the eighth day, they name you and introduce you into the tribe. And it's very done in a very unique little manner. Now, in my case, the gentleman that performed this ceremony had a black hat and a long black beard, a long white robe, and his tool in trade was a sharp little knife, you know. Now, he's not licensed for surgery and anesthesia in the normal procedure. So he has a godfather as a helper, and the godfather's job is to get an old-fashioned iced tea glass, and in my case, they fill it full of 100-proof old bourbon, and then he takes a wad of gauze and he soaks it thoroughly in the bourbon. And then, to put the baby to sleep, as I was told they did in my case, then the godfather puts one hand over the baby's mouth and takes the gauze that's immersed in bourbon and wafts it gently in front of the baby's nose and let him inhale the fumes and go to sleep. And right when that man with that little knife said ready, you know, that's when the godfather opened up my mouth and forced that alcohol and that booze in me, and that's when the first drink of alcohol was forced down me against my will. And I've had a heck of a problem ever since. So very humbly and honestly, you see, I had to give up something before I ever got started in this deal. But seriously. And when she said that, I wanted to drink bad, and my mind closed. And I didn't hear anything in the rest of that meeting. Now, it wasn't until after I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they shoved a book in my hand. And incidentally, may I remind those that are here, it is the only book in print with those two words on it. There is not another book like it, near like it, better than, worse than, if it's not Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only book with two words on it. And it wasn't until after I began to read the doctor's opinion did I realize at that time what was happening. And the sad thing about the illness of alcoholism is that you've got to get sober in order to look back where you've been. And because while drinking, you can't see where you're going and you can't see where you've been. But sober, we can look back and see. And so I remember, and I read in the doctor's opinion, that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And then he says that after a while we cannot differentiate the true from the false. And then the alcoholic believes that his life to be the only life. And that we're restless, irritable, and discontented until we can again experience the ease and comfort which seems to come at once after taking a few drinks. And here is where it happens. And once we succumb to the desire again, it sets up this phenomenon of craving for alcohol. And remember I told you that while getting dressed, I drank a half a quart of whiskey, and it wasn't what that woman said about Christ or anything else. My body was crying out for another drink. It demanded that I have another drink, and I wanted to drink. But you see, in that meeting, I violated a very serious code in my living because I started drinking with, working with, get drunk with, fighting with, you everything, with the black and the white bueno, which was then Skid Row. It's Skid Row today, and I guess it'll always be Skid Row in Dallas, Texas. And I've lived on three Skid Rows in my lifetime, one for over 6 years and one for 2.5 years, but the last one was the toughest. And I learned a lot of things down there, and I didn't have to be down there because I came from a family that could provide all of the love and all of the money and anything that any youngster could ever want growing up. I had the most beautiful mother and father and the most devoted mother and father that any son could ever have. And my mother and father dedicated their lives to the two boys that were born into that marriage to give them everything and anything that was denied them. And my father became a tremendous financial success. And if I would have listened to my mother and father, time I was 40 years of age, I never would have had to work another day in my life. I'd have had enough money for all my great-great-grandchildren and for a lot of y'all's great-grandchildren and a lot left over. And so I never fell out with my mother and father because they couldn't provide these things. I fell out with them when I got drunk and I got into jails and I got into institutions and I got into trouble. I would go to them and I'd look at my daddy. Now, my mother ran the family. And when she was 76 years of age, she was only 4'11½", and she had a backhanded slap with her right and her left hand that was faster than any rattlesnake you've ever seen. And my daddy was afraid of her. Her rabbi was afraid of her. Everybody's afraid of my mother. And my daddy wouldn't do anything. He'd look at my mother, and my mother would look at me and says, "Well, Papa, he's a good boy, a little different from his brother. Let him have it." And Daddy would give it to me. So as long as I could go to Daddy, and Daddy look at Mama, and Mama look at me and say, "Let him have it, Daddy." He'd give it to me. I'd go to Daddy. He'd look at Mama. Mama look at me. "Let him have it, Daddy." And I'd take it and flee. And I did this unashamedly till I was 47 years old, you know, until they, too, had to chip me away. I learned a lot of things down there on Skid Row. You know, I hear a lot of alcoholics talk about how they started drinking that good stuff, and as times got bad, they got down. I started as a starter, as a youngster, 11½ years of age, on bay rum and wine, you know. Yeah, that was a standard drink. And later on, as I grew older physically, with a little more money in my pocket, I could go from bay rum and wine to Johnny Walker Black Label Scotch and never miss a lick. And then I could come back down from that good Black Label Jack Daniels down to Gypsy Rose and Thunderbird and never miss a lick. Because I don't know about anybody in here. I wasn't drinking that alcohol because of the price of it, the smell of it, what kind of bottles it come into, whether it made you a better dancer, better fighter, worse fighter, better lover, worse lover. I was drinking there because I liked the effect that it produced within me. And what happened after the effect produced within me happened to me. And what happened to you, but it happened. And so I was drinking that stuff because the first drink that I could consciously remember that I took, which was at a young age because liquor has been in our home all of my waking hours and living hours and sleeping hours. We were taught to drink it in moderation. That our kind don't become alcoholics. All right, for Gentiles, they deserve it, but not our kind. No? Yeah. And Jews don't become alcoholics, and, you know, and do this. And I was programmed and who to marry, what not to marry, and don't care if she's fat, green, ugly, or what. If she's Jewish, it's fine, but don't bring one of them blue-eyed blondes home from them other kinds. Or you got to go, and I like them blue-eyed blondes, and out I went, you know. And all of these things, and I was programmed in that kind of a life, you know. And I learned a lot of things down there on Skid Row. Never get you back up against the back wall. But I'm going to tell you about that first drink I took consciously. I remember 6 years of age. It affected me in such a way that I liked the effect. Little did I realize it planted something in my head that every chance I get, I'm going to take a drink of alcohol that will reproduce that initial effect. And if you read the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of the greatest, greatest, greatest descriptions of our kind of people, and particularly the obsession in the chapter to the agnostic, that we hope we've made it perfectly clear, or clear, the difference between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. That if when you honestly want to, you can, I mean, that the idea that somehow, someday, he will be able to, or to control and enjoy, actually it's chapter 3. The idea that somehow, someday, he will be able to control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker, not a normal drinker. And if there's anyone in this room, and there's always, you know, whether you got 50 or 100 or 1,000, always sucking on his thumb, trying to control his drinking, I want to ask you one question. Why are you trying to control it if it's not out of control? Just drink. Whether you realize that you're an abnormal drinker. I didn't realize this. And I learned all these things on Skid Row. You know, never get your back up against the wall. Always have a back door or window that you can jump out of, you know, or you'll get caught. And I used to get caught, and I'd got many a days and hours as a youngster in jail. And then always, you know, if you smoke a cigarette or anything, keep both hands free. And I was 5 foot six. I was born 5 foot six. I come out of the chute 5 foot six. And I drink that juice and I'd be 7 foot tall. I've had thousands of fights and I've never won a one. My nose has been where my right ear is. My right ear's been where my navel is. My navel's been where my eyes is, you know, and all of these things. And I also learned a lot of other things, you know. Never let a stranger put his arm around the back while I stick a knife in it. You become cold. And I learned it. When I was 17 years of age down on the road, I ran off one time and went with Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. Now, I'm going to tell you something. You have never drunk till you've been with the circus. And I look around here, and I don't see there's very many circus drinkers in here. And I learned a beautiful concoction called Green Lizard Circus Style. That's a beautiful drink, you know. That's elixir, sodium bromide, and Lucky Tiger hair tonic. And I drink that stuff, and I used to see Bambi and those animals in Technicolor long before Walt Disney had put them on. And here I am, I'm sitting in that meeting, I violate a code, I'm on the back row, and this woman's talking about Christ, and I want my craving for a drink, and there's no back window, there's no door to jump out of, and I'm hating everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous at that meeting. And my wife's on one side of me. The lady that invited me to come to that birthday party is on one side of me. Her sponsor is in front of me, and the man who is my sponsor today also was at that meeting. He's sitting to her left. And every time I stood up to walk through 80 people to go out to the car to get that half quart of whiskey, it looked like 80 people stood up, turned around, looked at me, and said, "Sit down and shut up." And I couldn't wait till that meeting was over with. And then when it was over with and everyone went for the ice cream and coffee and the cake and started that smoking and hugging and kissing again, I ran through all those people and I went out to that car and opened up that trunk and I got out that half quart of liquid gold. Now, I don't know about anybody in here, but I drank that half quart down in two swallows. Now, that's the way I drank alcohol. You know, I didn't put it in a brandy glass and run around and sniff it for 4 hours and light candles and listen to Lawrence Welk, you know. And I didn't put an inch in a glass and 7 inches of something else and straw and fruit and cherry and suck on it for about 4 hours, you know. To me, that's sick drinking, you know. I drank that stuff to drop her down that hole where it'll do the most good. And put another one down. And I've had a lot of them taste just good coming back up, dead going down, you know. But what happened when it got down there? Oh, this great feeling. Gosh, once it got down there, I quit perspiring. My hair laid down. My toes went back into those alligator shoes. And I looked down at the face of that Hawaiian hula girl, and I had the most beautiful, serene look you'd ever seen on her life. And I ran up the steps past those two drunks and ran into the meeting and got hold of the oldest sober member of the group at that time, still alive, still the oldest sober member, and I got to arguing with him about the quality of y'all's fellowship. And he said something to me, and I hit him. And two more joined, and we had a fight. And then they got a fourth one, and four of them picked me up, two on each side bodily, and threw me right out of that group, right over the two drunks on the steps, right out on the yard. And then one of them said something to me as I was sailing through the air that gave me another good excuse to drink. He said, "We don't need your kind here, and anyway, you're too young to be an alcoholic." And as I landed on the grass and I got up, they hurt my feelings. Number one, they ripped my new suit. But the feelings of all feelings were bruised when I looked down and I saw they scuffed the toes of my brand new alligator shoes. And I stood there on that grass that Sunday evening with my fist clenched, drunk, belligerent, and screaming to anybody that would listen to me that I would never come back to this Christ soul-saving anti-Semitic organization as long as I live. That I wasn't an alcoholic. I was too young to be an alcoholic. I was 30 years of age, yet at 30 years of age, I wasn't going to tell anybody that I had already been apprehended over 14 times, not for just being drunk, but for not being in school, laying out on the sidewalk, down on the road, and out, and not people not being able to look for me in blackouts. I wasn't going to tell anybody that. And the next 17 years after I left that meeting, drunk and screaming and belligerent, everything that could possibly happen to a human being happened to this human being, with the exception of two things. And I like the expression of a friend of mine, and it happened to me. The only two things that didn't happen to me is that I never did willfully murder another human being or fall in love with another man. I just did it all, you know. And so when I admit to you that I am an alcoholic, I have to automatically admit to you that I am powerless over alcohol. And when I admit to you that I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and sober, I have to admit to you that my life had become unmanageable, because if I could have managed my life, I could have managed my drinking, and there was no way in the world I could do it. And 3.5 years after I got left that meeting drunk, now, I was recalled back in service shortly after that. Didn't have to go. It gave me a chance by that time to get way away from my creditors, because my family relationship had already begun to deteriorate with my wife, and two wonderful little boys were born to that marriage. Now, I was a stay-away-from-home kind of a drinker. I'd be gone 3 weeks at a time, 6 weeks at a time, 6 months at a time. And I'd come back home, you know, no one knew where I was, and I'd come in with a 6-week growth of beard and smell like a goat, and I'd run in the house, and I'd ask my wife this brilliant question. Did anybody call? And then I'd run and I'd want to put my arm around and hug her and kiss her. After all, I hadn't seen her, you know. And she'd say, get away from me. I don't want to have a thing to do with you. You're drunk. You smell bad. Get away from me. And our kind of belligerent, you know. And we can't take no for an answer. And incidentally, we can't handle a yes a lot of the times either. And so I'd run and make another pass at her. And she said, get your hands off of me. I don't want to have a thing to do with you. And I'd look at her stunned. And I'd grab my friend, that old Crow bottle, and I'd go into the living room, and I'd get my favorite drinking glass, which was usually about an 8-ounce or 10-ounce peanut butter jar. Now, that's a respectable drink. It's wide-necked, you know. And I'd already be drunk, and I'd slosh in 4 or 5 more ounces in and drink it. And I'd sit in that chair in the living room, and I'd have to close my left eye and put my left hand over it to keep it steady, so the right eye. And I'd wait for her profile to come, where she'd come from the kitchen into the dining room, into the bedroom, to check on the two little boys. And I'd catch her and I'd look at her. And I'd say, my God, what's going to happen to me next? Here she is. She's not even 26 and a half years old. And she's already going through the early change of life. Of all the people it has to happen to, it's just my luck to have married a frigid woman. And if this be the case, I'm going out and I'm going to find me the woman that will understand me. So I grabbed my whiskey bottle and I went out looking for the woman that would understand me. I looked all over the world for the woman that would understand me. And after I was sober, 3.5 weeks in Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked in the kitchen there. She'd been there all along. Raising the children and lying to the creditors and hoping that this thing that she was married to, maybe he just disappeared. Maybe there's a $20 bill he overlooked. Maybe there was an insurance policy that he had forgotten about and not cashed in. But the thing that was destroying her, here she saw the man that she married and loved with every fiber of her being going totally down the drain. And she and the children were helpless and powerless to do anything about it, and was driving her crazy. I looked all over the world for people that would understand me. I couldn't find them, no wonder. Y'all were all in Alcoholics Anonymous. I come in, they say, we understand you. That shot that balloon right out of the air. And so I got recalled back in service, didn't have to go, but it gave me a chance to get away from that nagging wife that needed to have little things, money for little things, like, you know, like baby shoes, you know, and formulas, and that interferes with a drunk when he's drinking. You know, that slows you down. You got to start making up the lies again, you know, and all of these things. And so I got recalled back, and when I come to, I found myself then, and 3.5 years later after I left that meeting, the most uncomfortable spot that I'd ever been in my life up to that time. When I come to, I found that I was totally incarcerated in a military prison. I was a naval dental officer and was called back to service and attached to Fleet Marine Force, and I went with a combat unit. And when I come to, I found myself totally incarcerated in a military prison for things that I had done. And when I totally came to, I found that I was facing 25 years in the federal penitentiary, the loss of my license to practice a profession, the loss of my franchise as a citizen. And for 11 and a half months, for the things that I had done, I laid and hurt and cussed society because I had a leg iron locked around my right leg and a chain welded to the leg iron and the other end of the chain welded to a steel cot and the four legs of the steel cot immersed in concrete. And there were armed Marines around me 24 hours a day with M1 rifles and fixed bayonets and sidearms daring me to move. And I love today to see the little alcoholics and the older ones and we get, you know, sober and we get dressed and we're all wearing these new leisure suits. Whether you realize it or not, you're now in the best spot that you'll ever be in your life to take a hard, long, hard look at yourself. If you be alcoholic or a problem drinker, or as Tom's friend says, Max says, not have a drinking problem. You know when you have a drinking problem? When you run out of whiskey when you're drinking, that's when you got a drinking problem. But if you be alcoholic or a problem drinker, little did I realize it, but as I look back then sober now, I realize that I could not guarantee my conditions under any conditions nor my behavior after taking that drink of alcohol. And I laid there and I plotted against society. And I used my father's name and my mother's name and I lied like any good drinking drunk will do to get out and got the enlisted aid of their friends and politicians through connections and all this. And I'll tell you right now, it is not easy to get alcohol when one is totally incarcerated. But when this alcoholic, and little did I realize I was an alcoholic then, wanted to get alcohol, I managed to get it. And they moved me over to the interior of Japan for the trial. And I talk a lot about this because this is the nature of the malady. Now, there's going to be someone in this meeting tonight say, I didn't drink like David did. And I'm going to say, fine, I didn't drink like you did. And you're going to say, I didn't do the things that you did, David. And I said, fine, I didn't do the things that you did. And you're going to say, I didn't hurt like you did, David. And I say, fine, I didn't hurt like you did. There are more people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and hear these stories and say, I must not be an alcoholic because I didn't get an impaired driving or a 502 or they call it a DWI in Texas. I didn't lose my family. I didn't lose my job. I didn't lose this. I just can't stay sober. I got news for you. The kind that can't stay sober, that haven't had been locked up in jail, haven't lost families, haven't lost their money or anything else, they compose the largest bulk of members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're the hardest type to hit, you see. But every alcoholic in this room, or a room just like it all over the world, all suffer from a malady. This is the important thing. And there are three things that each and every one of us in this room, if we be alcoholic, or a room just like it all over the world, or anyone's ever drunk. Number one, living a lifestyle on our own, we could not reject that first drink. For realizing what happens to us every time we took the drink, yet after making promises and promises I'll never do it again, yet we did it again and again and again and again. And the second thing that's common to each and every one of us, and the only thing, and that's this, is none of us could put that, drink that juice and drop it in us, and then set the bottle down, living a lifestyle on our own, and walk away from it and stay sober the rest of our life. And the third thing, that when we drank, we got drunk. And then after we got drunk, these things happened to us individually. But the solution is a common solution. This is the beautiful thing that we can share. And that's all. And so it's the malady. Or as they calls it, what? The description of the alcoholic. They have two, that we are men and women who have lost our ability to control our drinking. And then in the fourth chapter, as I almost got tripped up a while ago, when it says we hope we have made it perfectly clear the difference between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. And I like this description of me better than any description I've ever read, and I've read thousands of them. And that is that if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount that you take. It doesn't say, do you take a drink in the morning? I never drank in the morning. I was already up drinking when morning come around, you know. But if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount that you take. And then the book is very gentle. It says, then you may be alcoholic, you know, or probably, rather. And I read that, and I said, I'm probably alcoholic, you know. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so here I am, I'm laying over there, and they moved me to the interior of Japan for this trial, and it was a nasty and a mean trial. And finally, and guys, they brought us some things that I didn't even know I'd done, you know. And it's the silliest thing in the world, you ask a drunk if he's been mean, he's gone, where have you been? And hell, if he'd have known where he'd been, he'd have stayed, he wouldn't come home to catch all that hell, you know. And so finally they went out for the verdict, and they come back and they asked that I step forward. You know what's worse than getting the message? Waiting to hear it. And what seemed like 3 hours, actually a minute and a half, the convening officer of the court martial stood up and said, the finding of this court, you're guilty. And I could see 25 years in the penitentiary. And they started reading off all the things that they were going to do to me, and they did to me. But because of my involvement of people, and some I had to make amends, one took his life, 3 were dismissed from the service, I didn't get any prison time. And once this, again, this alcoholic was not allowed to face the consequences of his acts. And it put this delusion in the illusion of mind, God, I'm greater than the Marine Corps. I'm greater than the Navy. I'm greater than the United States government. And they said, it's the court's over with. And but the convening officer says, now, I want to talk to you in just a few minutes. And he did. He took me in a corner and he says, now, being that you're in the Navy, attached to the Marine Corps, this is going to have to go through 2 judge advocates for a review. But you can have liberty. But if I were you, I wouldn't get drunk again. Now, he never should have told me that. And not having had on a uniform, I put it on. I said, after all, I have been incarcerated almost a year totally. I deserve companionship. I deserve a drink. I deserve to have a good time. And I'm going out in that little town. I'm going to have me a drink. Then I'm coming back. Then I'm going to thank who I have to thank. I went out of that little town in Japan and took a drink of alcohol. 3.5 weeks later, I come to. I'm aboard a helicopter. The next thing I know, I'm put on a military transport. The next thing I know, I'm back in that same military prison, same compound, same cell, same leg iron on the same right leg. And the sergeant of the guard and the duty officer of the day had nerve enough to stick both of their ugly faces in mine and ask me, what happened? And I had no defense. And the Marine Corps was so disgusted with me, they shipped me back to the Navy, who in turn shipped me back to the United States. Now, it's an amazing thing about our kind of people. When we get ready to get on a drunk, you know, we don't worry about our wives or children or mother or fathers or employers or neighbors or bankers or lawyers or anybody else or girlfriends, you know. It's coming off of a drunk. Then we begin to worry. I wonder what they know. Will they let me back in? So I hadn't sent any money home nor communicated with my family in over 3.5 years, and I started looking for my wife. After all, I am disgraced. I was found guilty. I'm broke. I have to start all over again, and so I have to have a place to live. Somebody to cook my meals, somebody to feel sorry for me, somebody to tell me how great I am, to love me, to mop my brow, somebody to say, now you stay here and get well, we'll move to a new town. If necessary, I'll go to work. And if necessary, I'll call my parents and see if they'll help us with some money. And if necessary, I'll call your parents, you know. And there's nothing that a drunk likes, and you know, if he's drinking, that's paradise, you know. And so I had to find my wife. It's important. I had to know one thing. Had I pushed her too far? Because if I did, I had to go get me another one, you know. Now, any woman that's ever lived with a drinking drunk knows what I was talking about. And so I started looking for my wife, and I didn't know where she was. And I finally, sense enough to call where she's from, Denver. And I called the phone, and a woman got on the phone, and I said, Grace. And she says, no. I said, who are you? She says, I'm the babysitter. I says, where is my wife? She says, why? She has a date, and she's on a weekend party in the mountains. And I said, how dare she? I said, well, give me the number. And she says, I'm sorry, but upon the advice of her lawyer, you're not to have any contact with her at this time. I said, where are the 2 boys? She said, they're playing across the street in the schoolyard. I said, go get them. I'm their father, after all. I haven't talked to them in over 3.5 years. She says, I'm sorry, but upon the advice of the same attorney, you're not to have any direct or indirect contact with your children at this time. And she hung up. And when she hung up, I said what every good self-respecting drinking drunk says when the people that he knows that'll never let you down in a crisis, that'll be with you to the bitter end, that'll stay with you through typhoons, hurricanes, snake bites, tornadoes, you know, let you down. I said these well-famous words, now that's gratitude for you. And I says, after all, here I am a returning hero, you know. Because, you see, when the plane winged in from the Far East and stopped at Midway Island, I ran into the ship service, and I bought 3 more rows of ribbons. And when the plane got to Travis Air Force Base, I had more rows of ribbons on my uniform than Eisenhower. Because, after all, I'm going to see my 2 little boys. You know, I'm going to see my 2 little boys. You know, and every mother and father wants their children to believe that they're the greatest mother and father in the world. And every mother and every mother and father and every nanny and granny wants to believe, you know, their children to believe they're the greatest father and mother and nanny in the world. You know? And I wasn't going to tell my 2 boys that I violated every act against God, man, the United States government, the United States Marine Corps, the United States Navy, and I was charged with every article in the court-martial manual except 1, treason. And I'm going to tell you right now, when you are locked up in a military prison during wartime and it's your own side, you know, that's degrading. And I wasn't going to tell my boys this, you know. And so what did I do next? I did then what nearly most good self-respecting drinking drunks have done at one time. I went down to my room. I got a bottle of whiskey. I got a pencil and paper. I don't know why it's so difficult to get a pencil and paper after we get sober for the 4 step, but I wrote one of those letters. Dear Grace, if you'll just take me back, I promise you I'll never take another drink of alcohol as long as I live. Put a period, poured 4 ounces of whiskey and drank it, you know. You see, I put a condition on staying sober. I didn't write her, Grace, there's come a time in my life where alcohol has to be totally eliminated from me. Whether you and I will ever be together again as husband and wife, whether I'll be able to again be a father of those children, whether I will ever be able again to practice as a professional man, whether anything. But alcohol has to be totally eliminated from my life. No conditions. But I put a condition on staying sober. If you will just take me back, I promise you I will never take another drink as long as I live. And I'd write, we'll move and change and all these things, you know. And took it over to San Francisco to mail it, and 2.5 weeks later, the shore patrol found me half-dressed, half-undressed, half-up, half-down a flight of stairs on a Skid Row hotel on the Embarcadero, and the letters still in my pocket. The Navy so disgusted with me, they shipped me back and cut my orders for release for 48 hours, rather, and that's how I got out of the service. And I talked my wife into taking me back, and we moved 24 times before I come to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay. Sometimes fast, sometimes slow, sometimes with the sheriff, sometimes without him, just moved. And we decided that we were going to start a new life, and we're going to move out to West Texas and to move to a small town and raise our 2 boys in a Christian community. Now, in West Texas, a Christian community of 3,500, that's a town that votes dry and drinks wet. And so we moved to this little town, and they accepted us, and we've had a lot of these kind of moves. And I was a daily drinker. I drank, you know, every day. And I got up to where I weighed 260 pounds, and my blood pressure was so high that every time my pulse would beat, my hair would stand straight up and pump like an oil well. And so I had a fat friend that was a physician and loved to drink in a little town up, and I went to see old George. And I went up there, and George says, what's the matter with you? And I said, I'm sick. And he says, well, let's have a drink before I examine you. And we had a drink. And then he put the blood pressure thing on, and he ran the air up, and he let it down, and he says, my God, David, it's a miracle you're alive. He says, your trouble is you're too fat. You need to lose weight. And knowing that you are a compulsive eater, I'm going to have to give you some help. And so he wrote me a prescription for 60 of the most beautiful capsules that you have ever seen in your life, Nemudons, and didn't say anything about not drinking. And he said, take 1 3 times a day. And so I ran back down to the little town and got it filled. And I went home to lose weight and stay drunk, you know. Well, you know, any good, I took it, said take 1 3 times a day. Well, any good self-respecting drinking, you know, if 1's good, 2's better, and 3's terrific. And so I went home and took 3 at once and drank about 4 ounces of that juice down, you know. And then I took 3 more and drank some more alcohol, and then my left hand that was holding the bottle, it got drunk, and the right hand that was dispensing the pills, it got pilled up, and they crossed, and I lost all contact. And I'm running into the bathroom, and I'm looking in the mirror, and, you know, I'm not losing any weight. I take 3 more. Our co-founder Bill wrote and said some profound things, but one of the greatest things he said, he says, you know, and when we're drinking, time is so slow, it's called time out of mind. And the only sad thing I have found about Alcoholics Anonymous is that time passes so fast sober, where does it go? It's the only sad thing. And I don't know, I drank more whiskey and I guess I took them all. And the next thing I knew, I was out in my backyard and I was picking peaches off of rose bushes. And they tell me I ran around that little town of 3,500 for 2 days talking in the unknown tongue, you know. And being one of two Jewish families in five counties around, they gathered everybody in to see the miracle. Because word spread like wildfire, the Jew had caught the Holy Spirit. Works for me, she moves over to him, then the patients, and once again, me and the bottle. Oh, we finally moved back home and started all over again, and my God, it never got any better, it got worse. And it was during this time that everything went down the drain, and I started living, and I tried to kill myself the last year that I drank two times, and I ended up in jail both times. And I was living then on wine, and I was in a flop house back in the area where I started to work, one of those 75-cent a night hotel rooms with your two shoes tied around your neck. And I got down to where all I had was a pair of thermal underwear, an old gray pair of flannel pants with all of my possessions in my pockets, an old gray sweater with the elbows out of the elbows, no socks, but I still hadn't quite lost everything yet. I still had an old pair of beat-up alligator shoes. And it was during this time that no one knew where I was, my mother and father. Prior to this, in the religion in which my mother and father were devout in, and they lit the candles of the dead for 7 consecutive days, and on the 8th day, their son was no longer alive in their mind, and that's the greatest thing that they could have done for them. That's total release. Total release. My wife, out of desperation, went to work for a place that she hated with every fiber of her being for the people that I started to work for in the same area that I started drinking when I was 11 and a half years of age. She didn't know where I was. And yet all in the world she had to do was look out the west window of her office many, many a morning. And she'd see me fall out of a wino hotel if she could see me. And I wanted to be a part of society. I didn't want to be this way. And I'd hide under those 18-wheeler trucks and under those docks and just to look for it. It's the only woman that I have ever loved in my life, and I was no longer a part of it, and I wanted to be a part of it. And I wanted to be functioned, but I could not stop drinking. I don't know about anybody in here. I didn't have any trouble drinking, and I didn't have any trouble getting drunk. I had trouble staying sober. Not until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous did I find this out. And they told me when I got here, if you don't take and use these things, you're going to have more trouble staying sober. If you don't want to have any trouble staying sober, just do these things. Just do them. Don't argue about them. Don't fight about them. Just do them. And the more you do them, the better it is. And this has turned out to be true in my life. And so consequently, I'd crawl on those trucks to look for her, and maybe, and I went home once, hoping that I could be a part of that family, and she looked at me and she says, do you have to drink as much as you do, and do you have to do the things that you do? And I guess I told her the only truthful thing in my life up to that time, and I says, yes, I have to, I can't stop drinking. And I says, why don't you find another man and marry him that'll be a husband to you and be good to you and find someone that'll be a good father to those children? I can't function, and I'd stumble out. and I tried to kill myself, and I got to the point in my life to where I couldn't stay sober, and I couldn't stay drunk, and I couldn't eat, and I wanted to eat, couldn't work, wanted to work, couldn't stay alive, and couldn't kill myself, couldn't, total saturation. It's a hellish, hellish existence. And somewhere along the line, around about April the 18th or 19th, I don't know when, of 1967, I found the handwriting on the floor of the Dallas County Jail. That's not the first time I'd been in that jail. And the next to the last time I was in that jail, as I was being released, the sheriff asked that I be brought before him. And he looked at me and he says, David, if you ever show up in my jail again for drinking or drunk, I will have you put away to where you'll never bother another human being, bird, tree, dog, or rock. Do you understand that? And I said, yes, sir, Mr. Bill. He says, you can leave. And I understood him so well. I walked right out of his office, right into a wine shop, got me a bottle of wine, and got out into the park with the rest of the winos and pigeons and grinned. I beat him again. And there I found myself on the runway. But by this time I run out of money, I run out of whiskey, I run out of people, I run out of everything. And I got down to me, and me couldn't stay sober, and me couldn't stay drunk, and me couldn't stay alive, and me couldn't kill myself, and me didn't want me as me was. But me was going with me every place me went. And I screamed out, my God, who's going to take care of me now? And then I screamed out the two things that I believe I needed to scream out and start believing if I were ever to get sober and stay sober. I said, my God, is there any help for me? And as I look back sober right this minute, I realized that when I screamed out, my God, is there any help for me? I know now that there not only was a God for me then and help for me then, because I am still here. And that's as simple as I have to put it. And then something was flashing in me. If I ever get out of this jail, you talk about a drunk don't know how to pray before he comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know about you. I was locked up in a jail one time, and I was coming off of a drunk, and nobody would give me any whiskey, and I darn near shook to death. And I got down on my knees, and I prayed fervently, and I said, God, if I ever get out of this jail alive without dying coming off this drunk, I promise you I'll never try to get sober again as long as I live. You betcha. In a minute. And I said, but something triggered in me, AA, AA, after I had exhausted all alternatives for me. You see, over 26 years ago, a group of fine, sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous could see in me what I could not see in myself. They didn't care whether I wanted AA, whether I needed AA or anything else. They tried to carry the message to me. And little did they realize they planted something in me that after everything else was exhausted and chipped away to do it my way, there it was. And so the only place I never had been to stay was Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know what? The only place I've got to come to today and stay is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's still the only place for me. And so I said, if I ever get out of here, I'm going to hunt those people up. Well, I didn't know where Edith was. I found out later she died sober. I didn't know where Moena was. She had moved away. And Moena, incidentally, celebrated her 27th consecutive anniversary of this past month. And she is my manicurist, and I see her every Wednesday morning. So I started looking for this man, W.O. I had read where he had gotten drunk and was thrown in jail. And so I started looking for him. And I got out of that jail, and how I got by that old sheriff that day, I don't know, but I got by. And I started stumbling out in an area where I thought I used to live in that old office of mine, which had already been closed. But by that day, and it wasn't luck and it wasn't coincidence, the lady who used to work for me was there looking to see if maybe if there's some mail that was due her. She took one look at me and she says, my God, doctor, you look sick. And I says, yes, I am. I'm sick in the head and sick in the gut. Just like the double blank on the domino, double nothing, held together by a shell. Would you dial a number for me? My eyes are too crossed to read it. And I gave her the man's name. She called him up. She said, well, we don't have a phone. I said, borrow one. And I got on the phone. This man said, who is this? And I told him. He said, what do you want? I says, W.O., are you still interested in Alcoholics Anonymous? He says, yes, I am. Then he said, who is it for? I said, it's for me. He says, well, we have a meeting tomorrow night. Let's just go and get it over with. And don't you take a drink of alcohol this day and call me tomorrow. And he hung up. And that's all he told me. And after coming to your fellowship in here in love and care and share, I was wondering where it was that morning when I called him. But you see, that man knows me as well as any human alive. And he knew that when I called him, I had run out of every Jew in the Southwest, and I got down to you Gentiles, I was in serious trouble. Now, that's what you call deflation of ego and debt. And the next 24 hours is the hardest 24 hours I ever spent in my life. I never sobered up in a goony roost, you know. And, you know, if I had a headache, I took a drink. Didn't have a headache, took a drink. Wanted to go to the bathroom, took a drink. Didn't want to go to the bathroom. Wanted to get out of bed, took a drink. I was just drinking because I was drinking. Couldn't stop drinking because I couldn't stop drinking. And the next 20, that's the hardest 24 hours I ever spent in my life. Just cold turkey after 37 years of drinking. Well, more like frozen buzzard. That's what it was. And I ran into the wall and had those fits and I jumped. But when I come to the next morning, I was sober and I didn't have a belly full of tranquilizers. Nor did I have a prescription for 500 more. And for this, I am so thankful. And I called him 7:30 in the morning. I says, W.O., where's that meeting? He says, are you drinking? I says, no. He says, don't you take a drink today and call me this afternoon. And he hung up. And finally, at 3:30 in the afternoon, I called him again. I says, W.O., where's that meeting? He says, are you drinking? I says, no. He says, do you really want to come to that meeting? By this time, I was willing to crawl through 6 foot of snow naked just to see what kind of people you were that had this insatiable desire not to drink alcohol. And I, the belligerence of a drunk, I says, I'll get there under my own steam. Where is it? He says, okay. I'll tell you where it is, and when you turn the corner, there's a whiskey store on your left and a beer joint on the right. Don't you stop and buy and consume any alcohol, because when I get out there, I'm going to search you and I'm going to smell you. And David, if you're drinking or drunk, I'm going to throw you through the front door. You, David, cannot come to Alcoholics Anonymous drinking or drunk. You understand? And he hung up again. Well, I was in a serious predicament. Because somewhere between the jail and that phone and calling him and shaking out a drunk, I lost my thermal underwear and my belt. Now, if you drank wine like I did, you'd understand it. And then I knew that my wife had thrown out all of my clothes, you know. And so I called her up. Now, she hadn't heard from me in 7.5 months. And I called her up and I says, Grace, and she says, who is this? And I said, it's me. And she said, who is me? And I said, it's David. She said, oh. I said, Grace, do you happen to have one of my old suits? And she says, yes, I have one, and it's to bury you in. And as I look back now, I then ask her the most foolish question I ever asked her in my life. I said, do you mind if I borrow it for a little while? I said, I'm going to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. She said, it's another one of your lies and hung up. And just to show you how I was confused, the house that I infrequently visited was just 4.5 blocks from the phone that I used. And I got dressed, and that suit's a store in itself. And I didn't have a shirt with about one button on it, and I had to borrow a tie from my youngest son for a belt and a tie, and I put on the brown socks to hide the holes in the alligators. And then I waved my wife and son goodbye. There was no hugging and kissing when I come home and told him I was coming to AA. Nope. And then I got into a Mustang that the bank was looking to repossess it, but they couldn't recognize it. It looked like an accordion. And off I went to this meeting, and it's a Friday night. And I went out there, and I walked through the doors, and it looked like the same people that were there on the last Sunday in August of 1950. They were smoking cigarettes and grinning, and everybody, and there's a man that stands at the door and meets all the new people, and I hope I never forget that handshake as long as I live. He stuck out his hand, and I grabbed it, and his was dry, and mine was wet, and mine slipped away, and I had to grab it again. And I believe that's how we slip away from Alcoholics Anonymous, by getting wet again. And now I'm going to tell you about the greatest AA talk I've ever heard in my life. I believe that every member of Alcoholics Anonymous hears it at one time or another, and we need to be reminded over and over and again. And I have been fortunate enough to hear our co-founder Bill on in person on occasions, and a lot of great talkers in Alcoholics Anonymous, but this is the greatest AA talk I've ever heard. This man then said to me, welcome, come in, sit down and have a cup of coffee, and let's talk about it. We understand exactly how you feel. That is the greatest AA talk I ever heard in my life. And here comes W.O., and he snatched me away from that man. And he took me in the men's room, and he started searching me, and he said, bro. And when he snatched me, the sleeve of that coat just ripped off, you know. And he says, you're clean, you can go in there. And have you ever seen a sick, stinking, shaking drunk come into a group of sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, about 80 of them, just like a, you know, a new dog coming in the neighborhood? Everybody looking at him and sniffing him, you know. And there's always that old-timer's there. He never saw me before in my life. He took one look at me, dropped his glass, and said, he'll never make it. And then word spreads like, well, we not only have a new drunk, he's a doctor. We, you know, we kill more doctors in Alcoholics Anonymous for to get good and sober. Word spreads like a doctor. Why, look what kind of high-class people we're getting into this thing. You know, we'll get the doctors and we'll get judges. Maybe we'll get the president of the United States. Won't the first lady make one hell of an Al-Anon, you know? We'll upgrade Alcoholics Anonymous. We'll reach more of them kind of people, you know, with by getting them things. How can you upgrade God? And I believe that the only way that we can upgrade the quality of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is by taking and using the recovery program and staying sober and helping other alcoholics to achieve sobriety, our primary purpose, unencumbered for the thing that's been given to us as a free gift. And word spreads like wildfire, he's not only a doctor, you know. And you know, they don't know whether you're an MD or a veterinarian or a DDS or a PhD or whatever you are. And I'm standing there and I'm shaking and gosh, and kind of enjoying this thing, you know. And I feel a tug at the back of my coat and this voice says, doctor. And I turn around and it's a goofy looking little woman. And she says, doctor. You know, that's the nicest I've been called in a long time, because when I got to you people, there's two things I understood. Shut up and get in, you know. And she says, doctor, and I said, yes, you know. And she says, I have a problem. And I said, yes. And she says, my right ovary is bothering me. And before I could tell her that I was a dentist, I wasn't a real doctor, a physician, you know. She says, is it all right if I take Valium and B12? And so, well, she's got me in the trap, you know, and every drunk is smart. And I dust myself off with that one-sleeved coat. And I look down at her professionally and I say, well, honey, if the roots of your teeth are that long, take them, you know. Here comes W.O., and he overheard it, and he's okay, wise guy, and grabbed the other sleeve, and it come off. He said, the fun's over with. You're here for serious business. He says, some people may be shocked at our apparent worldliness and levity, but just underneath there's a deadly earnestness and a full realization that we must put first things first. And first things first with us, he told me, is our alcoholic problem. Not our living problem, not our wife problem, not our money problem, but our alcoholic problem. And he says, an AA will show you if you are an alcoholic, and you damn sure are, he told me. How an alcoholic can live and nothing that comes across the pike, you got a reason to take a drink anymore. God Almighty, he instilled in me right then and there, and there's no situation too difficult or no unhappiness too great. And then a drink of alcohol will never make it any better, it'll make it worse. And then he took me in and he introduced me, and I'd like to tell you about something. Betty ran the steps last night, and I want to tell you about when I got ready to take the fifth step with this sponsor of mine. Oh, he's mean. I've threatened if I ever saw him on the freeway, I'd run over him. And I went down to take the fifth step with him, and he said, come down at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I went down there and he told his secretary, he says, cut all the incoming phone calls off. And I went in there. He says, did you do the part of the fifth step before you got here? I said, what are you talking about? He said, did you admit to God and admit to yourself before you come down here to me? I says, nobody does this. They do it all under one roof. He says, no, that's what it says. Admit it to God, admit it to yourself. You didn't do it. He says, go do it. I says, I'm not going to do it. He says, you'll do it. He says, now you go into the men's room and you close the door. And then he says, you go into the corner of the commode thing and lock the door and admit to God the exact nature of your wrongs. And then come out and there's a wash basin and a mirror. And then you look in the mirror and it, you admit to you. And then you come into me. I says, you're crazy. He says, you're going to be crazy. Now get out there. And I'm scared of my sponsor, still am. But everything he told me is the truth and I'm afraid to cross it. So I go out there and I go into the restroom and I lock the door and there's nobody else in me, and I felt like a fool when I went in the corner and slid the bolt on the other door. And so I admitted to God the exact nature of my wrongs, and I unslid the bolt, and I went to the, looked in the mirror, and I started admitting to me, and guess what? I caught me telling me not what I told God in the corner. I said, my God, if I told God one thing, me one thing, what am I going to tell him? So like a fool, I went back and slid the bolt in the corner again. I admitted to God again, and I come back out and looked in the mirror, and it sounded reasonably the same. So I went in there, and he said, you ready? And I said, yeah. He told the secretary to cut the calls off, and he said, how many times you go in the corner? I says, 2 times. He says, I went 3. And then he says, David, he says, for a reason. He says, if you go around spreading all your dirty linen to everything and everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to run across somebody that says, oh, you're not really that bad. You may not even be an alcoholic. And you're liable to believe him. He says, now, God's all in and through us and all around us. You're here and I'm here. He says, let's do it and then dump it and get to the next 2 steps. And he'll tell you where to put it. And I'm so thankful for sponsorship of this nature. Sponsorship of this. Now, brook no foolishness, you know. If you got one like that, feed him, fan him. Hope he doesn't get drunk. It'll be the greatest experience you'll ever have in your life. And so here I am, you know, and he starts in me, and he introduced me to another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He starts telling me what it used to be like, what happened. And now for a few short moments, I'd like to talk to you how it is today in my life. Because Betty ran the steps, and I'd like to talk to you how the steps have affected my life in their entirety. Little did I realize when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, my wife and 2 boys would ever be under one roof again. Because that marriage had been written off not only by us, but by everything and everybody, but only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, and only because of God's grace through the Al-Anon program in my wife's life, that beautiful and wonderful woman, we celebrated our 33rd consecutive wedding anniversary this past June the 10th, and that's pretty good for a drunk. Because it took a program in my life and a program, a recovery program in her life, to do to and with and for us what we could not do to and with and for ourselves. And today she doesn't walk out in front of me and me behind her and me in front of her and she behind me. It's side by side. And I'll tell you something, if you're going to live with a woman, the best way to live with them, just live the truth. It sure is comfortable. She's an Alateen sponsor with a big group. And our home, and you know, she goes to 7 meetings a week in Al-Anon, and I go 7 meetings a week or better to AA, and we don't see each other that much to have all that damn aggravation. And we have a mutual respect, and we have a lots to talk about, and we can sit for hours in the living room and never say a word to each other, yet we know we're there. We don't have to anymore. And I don't have to look at her and say, well, what have I done now? You know? Yeah. Or what's wrong with you? You know, and the backache and the headache doesn't bother me anymore because I'm getting old enough to accept it. My 2 boys. My oldest boy, when he was 15 years of age, he put a butcher knife to my breastbone one Sunday morning. And he says, I'm going to kill you for what you're doing to our mother. And if I could have gotten off the floor, I'd have beat him to death. And then the wildness left his eyes, and he turned his back, and he dropped the knife, and he turned around, and he spat in my face, and he says, you're no longer my father, and I'm not your son, and he walked out of my life. And that hurts. You notice what I said? He was going to kill me for what? Not what I was doing to he and his brother, but his mother. And this is how the children are affected, because children that grow up in a home have to have someone to reach out for sanity, for strength, someone to have their little birthday parties for, someone to give them show money, to take them to school and to love them. And their mother was their mother was their father, their mother was the love and everything else. And they cling to their mother for sanity, and they couldn't stand to see what I was doing to her, because I was taking away from them the only decency in life, and they were willing to sacrifice me for her. But because of God's grace and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, in my life, and because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, and although they weren't in Alateen because they were getting into college in those years, and being on the same level of the osmosis of the spiritual being in Alcoholics Anonymous. Today, that beautiful and wonderful son of mine, we not only have a beautiful father and son relationship, but more important, we're the best of friends, and this is great. And my youngest son, God, here is, you know, I couldn't bring anybody home. My youngest children, rather, couldn't bring anybody home. We were living in the panhandle to play. Because they used to lock me up in a little room, 8.5 by 11. And, you know, with the windows were barred, and I had a bed and a dresser and a mirror and a can with a lid on it and my whiskey. And I'm going to tell you about the door. The door had one doorknob on it, and the doorknob was in the hall. And I don't know if any of you ever laid in a hammock or in the back of a car or under a tree or somewhere and your children are playing and you can hear them playing and the neighbor's little boy used to come home and he says, uh-oh, I see your daddy is home and the door's open and there's a whiskey bottle in the car. Your daddy's nothing but the town drunk. And you hear your little boy say, don't talk that way about my father. I love him. He's my daddy. And then run in the house and hear the words and hear the sobs and these are the tears that go through 60 feet of concrete and 100 feet of steel and you can't block them out. And he'd say, why can't my daddy be like other daddies? Why can't he take us to the Little League? Why can't he take us on vacations? Why is he gone all the time, and when he's gone, he's drunk, and when he comes home, he's drunk, and all you and daddy do is fight and argue and scream all the time? Why? And you don't want to be this way. And you reach under the bed, and you get your drink, and you crawl to that door, and you don't know. You talk about lonesomeness, and you talk about a feeling of despair when you scratch on a door, and there's no doorknob, and you can't get out. And you wish you were dead. Well, because of God's grace and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, and because of God's grace to the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon and the other goodies, we two not only have a beautiful father and son relationship, but we two are friends. And I'll tell you a little story about that young man. Last fall, he interviewed for a job with the district attorney of Dallas County to be head of the Career Criminal Justice Department. And as he went in there to interview with him, the district attorney pulled something out of the drawer, and he says, Donnie, he says, 25 years ago this day, while you're here, I came to work as a star-eyed, new prosecuting assistant district attorney for Dallas County. And so I brought a diary to work that day because I thought my first day in the DA's job would be that memorable, and one of these days I could look back. And he says, I'm going to hand this to you, and I want you to read what's in it. And Donnie looked at it, and this is what it was on that day. The first thing that was on the agenda is what to do with one Dr. David H. Aronofsky. And Donnie looked at him, and he says, isn't sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous the greatest thing in the world? And Henry looked at him, and he says, you bet. And your daddy hasn't given us any trouble now going on 9 years. Is he? When I got sober, State Board of Dental Examiners were looking for me to serve with papers, not to give me a vacation and not to give me a suspension, but to remove my license to practice dentistry in all of the states in the union. And I had to go before them. Sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous found out about it, and they cornered me in the back room of that group, and they says, now when you get up there, don't you tell me you're in AA, and don't you make any promises now that you're in AA, you're going to stay sober and beg to give your license back on the strength of AA. You go down there and you tell them the truth of what you did before you got here. Just tell them I says, do I have to? They said, if you want to stay sober, you've got to. I says, you mean everything? They said, everything. So I went down there, and I told them I took a lot of people's money and never started their work, and the work I did, I wouldn't have my own mouth. And never will forget what one of the examiners said. He said, you mean you're not blaming it on the fact you recall back in the service? You're not blaming it on the fact the kind of woman you married, your religion, or anything else? You're not blaming it on the Democrats, the Republicans, the communists, and everything else? I says, no, sir. I said, if there be fault, let it be mine. They said, we've never heard anything like that around here before. He said, what's happened to you? I said, well, I fell in with a bunch of people. Said, if I didn't come down here and tell you the truth, I may not be able to stay sober. They said, we'll have to talk about it. They went back and he talked. Come back the next day. Talked some more. Said, you have a place to work? He says, no. Thanks. Get one? I said, I think so. You got any equipment? I said, I got two pieces, but the sheriff is looking to repossess them. They said, well, see if you can find a place to work and go to work, and we'll be checking on you one day at a time. And I've been there ever since, one day at a time. And 4 years ago, this past May, one of the doctors, one of the examiners that were there to remove my license over 9 years ago, they gave me my 25-year key in the American Dental Association. And I'm working on 29. I'm working on 30 now. Now, this is not me. This is all Alcoholics Anonymous.
You see? Oh, no, this is not me. This is all Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? Uh-uh. Because, you see, this is a deal. Our story, this is as a result of a colossal human failure converted into great strengths by the alchemy of the living grace of God, as is expressed through the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous and our fellowship therein. And you see, because of God's grace of the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to, nor have I taken a drink of an alcoholic nature since April the 20th, 1967. And because of God's grace of the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a sober life today. I have a woman that loves me. I have two boys that love and respect their father. I have the best way to make a living that I ever had in my life. I have a roof over my head. I have a few dollars in my pocket. I've got hundreds of thousands of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, Alateen, the outside world. I have a couple of these fancy new double-knit suits and two leisure suits. I've got two cars with gasoline in them. I've got meat in the refrigerator and grocery in the pantry. And I'll tell you a little secret. If you want anything any more than that, you're either oversexed or plumb nuts. And because of people such as you and A's, my groups, and A's all over the world have shown me that love and understanding are the keys to right principles and right attitudes, and right actions the keys to good living. This is a good way to live, not a life of goodness. But for David, a recovering alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous, our 12 steps of recovery in their entirety, our 12 traditions in their entirety, our third legacy in their entirety, and our 12 concepts of world service in their entirety are the keys to the kind of life that are meaning so much to me, one day at a time, but daily. And you know, we in Alcoholics Anonymous believe that anyone who can honestly face their problems in the light of our experience can recover, any alcoholic, provided he or she is willing to keep an open mind and search out all spiritual concepts. And that he or she will only be defeated by their own attitude of belligerent or belligerent denial. And that no one or nobody should have any troubles with the spiritual principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, for honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness are essentials of our recovery, but they are indispensable. And you know, we have people in Alcoholics Anonymous that are true believers, that's God as they understand Him. We have atheists that are sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's God as they understand Him. We have agnostics that are sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's God as they understand Him. And if you don't understand God, that's how you understand Him. Now, wiggle out of that. You see, it was just a matter with us as it was Bill. It's just a matter of Bill being willing to believe in a power greater than himself. No further requirement was necessary for him or for us to make a beginning. And I'd like to close with a little story now that's very personal to me. And there was a little youngster that was an orphan, and he lived in the Midwest in an orphanage, and he had a very terrible stuttering impediment. And every time he'd open his mouth, he'd stutter, and when he'd stutter, the youngsters would tease him, and then he would perform, and he would just go to pieces, and he'd go crazy, and he'd cry, and it just darn near drove him crazy. But something happened to this little boy. Something developed within him, an inner peace. And as the youngsters tried to get him to open up his mouth, and as long as he didn't open his mouth, he didn't try to talk, and we didn't try to talk, he didn't stutter, and he didn't stutter, he didn't perform, he didn't cry, and he went around just beautiful and peaceful. Something happened to him. No matter how they tried to antagonize him, he wouldn't open his mouth. And gosh, he walked around, just smiled at everybody, and it was something to see. And one Sunday morning, the visiting preacher didn't come, and they didn't have anybody to read the devotional prayer, so the superintendent of the school asked for a volunteer, and little stuttering Johnny held his hand up, and the superintendent looked at him and said, "Johnny, you sure you know what you want to do?" And he says, "Yes." "Well, come on." And as he went up behind the lectern, all the students said, "Johnny's going to stutter, Johnny's going to stutter." And he got behind the lectern and he opened up the prayer book and he began to read. And as he began to read, each letter was perfectly enunciated and each word was perfectly pronunciated. And as he began to read, there came from within him outward a look, the same look that